Thank you very much, Bill. Lying behind the tide of illegal immigration and legitimate demand for immigration that we have seen is the boiling and vital cauldron of Middle and South America. Think a little bit about the enormous resources of people, the opportunities that Mexico, Middle America, South America could hold, and also consider with dismay the fact that the cultural tradition and the economic education of the leaders and the ordinary people in those countries is often quite different from our own and does not accept many of the basic values of a free society. Our next speaker is a well-known expert on the Spanish and South American world. Marvin Leeske is a professor of political science at Arizona State. He is an author, a journalist, a diplomat, and a scholar. He has done the most incredible number of things. As a matter of fact, he's had a chance to travel 30-odd times almost every year to Middle America and observe at close hand what is happening there, what is driving this great force that is lapping at our doors. So I'd like to present to you Marvin Leeske.
When Mel Bradford invited me to speak to this distinguished assemblage, he said the Philadelphia Society, and that immediately conjured up in my mind upcoming constitutional bicentennial and, you know, the birth certificate of America's freedom, 1787. And then I was ignorant about this, and I knew about this fine assemblage of conservatives, but I wasn't sure about the name. And then I found out the name was not tied to the city of William's famous pen name, but rather the classical Greek philos, love of Delphi. I guess that was the site of the ancient oracle. And that really confused me because I'm no oracle. I'm a professional Latin Americanist. I deal with a region so politically volatile that the predictions that you can safely take on have a time frame of about 2 weeks. And I'm a former NBC news correspondent in Latin America, and so therefore I sometimes move a little too rapidly too. You've all noticed in recent years that TV network tendency to jump to confusions in reporting political news, unfortunately to the left. Well, as a bona fide professor, I've also learned to speak in 50-minute segments. Don Lipset, knowing about professorial loquaciousness, said, 20 minutes. Now, you're right, Don. After that, only a speaker's blood relatives are still with him, and they begin to fidget. So I'm going to imply more than time allows me to state in detail and let this educated audience infer what you will, and then we'll tidy things up during the question period. You know, after a heartbreaking earthquake, I guess I shouldn't say anything lighthearted about Mexico, but you can be a serious scholar, I suppose, without always being solemn. I hope so. I think conservatives in recent years, and since the age of Buckley, have demonstrated that compassion and sensitivity to suffering are not compromised by humor. If the liberals had a sense of humor, I guess they wouldn't be liberals. And humor does keep us from going insane, for one thing. You know, there's a lot of paradoxes in this, around this perplexed planet. Though, I don't know, I guess I'll drop some Mexican jokes and get on to my main speech. But anyway, Mexico is not only suffered a very, well, a disastrous blow from nature. But preceding the earthquake, it suffered for several years compounded corruption, bureaucratic bungling that brought on the gigantic foreign debt, made it possible, despite petrodollar profits. Last July, the conservatives of the National Action Party, PAN, PAN, without question, won the governorships of two key states, Nuevo León, just south of Texas here, and Sonora, which is just south of our Arizona abode, containing two of the dynamic major cities, Monterrey, Hermosillo. Yet the dominant PRI, the PRI, Institutional Revolutionary Party, which has governed Mexico since the party was established in 1929, did not choose to coexist with the PAN victories. Instead, ballot boxes were stuffed the night before the polls opened. Now, I cannot verify the PAN charges in the seven states with gubernatorial races or in all of the 31 states with congressional races. But I was on hand in Hermosillo, the capital of Sonora, on election morning, July the 7th. Mexicans don't get up as early as we do. They open the polls at 8. And about 9 o'clock, the PAN, realizing it had been defrauded, removed a few ballot boxes from the polling site number 18, where I was, and opened them. And it found more ballots marked for the PRI than there were registered voters for all eight parties in the specific voting district. So that was the Mexican equivalent of the Chicago Mayor Daley two-step. You dance the Mexican hat dance around the brim of superficial form and then kick in the crown of accuracy. Well, that's the PRI's interpretation of a great principle of democracy. One man, two votes. Well, I'm not here to condemn the Mexican Revolution. It's an ongoing series of reforms that began in 1917, and it did broaden the base of voting, and it did enlarge participation in public life manyfold beyond the narrow elitism of longtime dictator Porfirio Diaz from 1876 to 1911. And during the past six decades, Mexican leaders have modernized and industrialized, and they have diversified the economy. It'd be far worse off if Mexican Revolution hadn't happened. And to distinguish continuing policies of land reform, labor union benefits, that sort of thing, the revolutionary coalition, the establishment in Mexico, always spells the label, the Mexican Revolution, with a patriotic capital R to distinguish it from the earlier military revolts. Unlike Castro's radical regimentation of Cuba, in which the wealth-producing private sector and individual political rights were killed by the yoke of communism, Mexico for 70 years has managed to maintain a mixed economy, although the public sector naturally has grown too large. That's the thyroidic or cancerous tendency of statism everywhere, whereas the wealth-producing private sector has been regulated with enough Mexican red tape to decorate the coastlines of the Western Hemisphere with pop art. Now, ironically, although Mexico was the only Latin American nation not to break diplomatic relations with Cuba during the 1964-75 period when Castro was then under multinational quarantine from the Organization of American States, internally, Mexican governments have not hesitated to bash Marxist heads when the far left conspired to attempt an overthrow of the revolutionary coalition. They cheer guerrillas elsewhere, but don't tamper with their power. In 1968, from July 26th, Castro's anniversary of the beginning of his Cuban movement, that's why the riots started that day, July the 26th, 1968, to October the 2nd, the so-called Student Strike Committee rioted, destroyed millions of dollars worth of public and private property, bashing in both adversaries and bystanders in the process. The Mexican government and the dominant party, the PRI, had put their reputations on the line. Mexico was going to become the first Latin American nation to host a World Olympics, the only Latin American nation ever to do so. Beginning October the 8th, a fortune in government funds had built a sports city. If the communists, both Cuban and Mexican, could keep the unsophisticated student rioters going into October, the government might cancel the Olympics and then could fall from power. Despite the easily discernible scenario documented by several U.S., Mexican, and other scholars, the conventional thinking in U.S. academia still clings to the myth that the repressive government murdered helpless students. Well, finding such rot in textbooks, I shake my head in a disgusted salute to knee-jerkus maximus, an unfortunate result of academia's unbalanced line to the left in the game of life. What did the leftist critics expect the police to do when communist snipers atop tall buildings at the Plaza of the Three Cultures began picking off any uniformed figure within their telescopic gun sights? Cite an ACLU resolution translated into Spanish? The proof positive that the strike committee wanted martyrs, wanted to prevent any peaceful settlement, was its ridiculous demand that the government conduct negotiations live on radio. That's what they ask. Even titillating talk show hosts tape call-in questions to avoid airing four-letter words, reserving that privilege for rock musicians. No government would ever agree to a live broadcast of negotiations. No government. And not after 2 months of bloody rioting. The day after the 10 weeks of rioting started, on July the 27th, I was in Mexico City and I gave a very bland lecture on Mexican municipal funding before the Social Sciences School of the National Autonomous University of Mexico, UNAM. About 50 students heard my remarks. My wife and I stepped outside to see hundreds of rampaging students destroying irreplaceable murals. The main library had scrawled completely across it in paint, Biblioteca Carlos Marx. I turned to my wife and said, "What did I say?" Well, the unjustified 1982 expropriation of the private banks, which was a political ploy, the government already controlled dollar accounts. It's easy to make bankers into villains if you're in a third world country. The 1985 earthquake, inflation, corruption, especially since 1970, each of these have challenged Mexico's stability. But the 1968 riots represented a very serious challenge to the revolutionary establishment, probably the most serious challenge since Francisco Madero in 1910 launched the Mexican Revolution to substitute modern living for the centuries-old system that had been nurtured by Spanish colonialism and later by Mexican autocrats. That's why I stressed it in this talk. Most of you don't hear about that riot and the plot. It was the most serious challenge until now. But late 1985 finds the Mexican system facing its most dangerous challenge in this century. I believe that, and I've been watching Mexico my entire adult life. This is the most serious challenge right now. And no American, political or apolitical, should take any comfort in seeing our neighbor to the south in such a dangerous position. They irritate us with their stand on Central America, but that's beside the point that I'm making. Now, I've got some personal sympathy for the conservatives of the pond, because they understand the superiority of the marketplace economy. But if the PRI should continue to compound its blunders, I mean, isn't the pond that's going to take over? It's the Marxist-led alienated masses that could. And they could put a Castro or a Sandinista-type Daniel Ortega in power, right across our 1,800-mile border, not separated by 90 miles of Caribbean Sea, a la Cuba, or three other Central American republics in the Mexican landmass, right across the fence from where I live in Arizona, or the shallow Rio Grande, you people here in Texas, as Bill Murchison so ably and beautifully graphically reminded us, our border is unguarded, and millions of illegal aliens come across and invade the United States. Well, I know they do so for jobs. I concur with you, Bill. And they also repatriate millions of dollars back to their families. This is an American escape valve. But this escape valve is not publicly appreciated by the leaders in Mexico, governmental or civic. You never hear them saying, "Thank goodness for that." Never. I read the Mexican press daily. Never. I listen to live television from Mexico City on Channel 33 in my home, the dish. Never mention it. In fact, when Texas hesitated funding the education of children whose parents had no legal right to be here, the howls went up until a court ordered taxpayers to educate those children free of charge to them, not to us. Most Americans really don't know Mexico in true perspective, even if you live in the Texas borderlands. The image of the neighboring republic comes from the millions of illegal workers. Well, the liberals euphemistically call that undocumented migrants, you know. Well, those are politicians that don't want to face a confrontation, do they? They come up with a good phrase. But for millions of U.S. tourists, what is Mexico? Mexico is Acapulco, Cancun, Mazatlan, the resorts that possess an international undertow of fascination, where the jet set and the wet set meet the love boat people. Mexico has an Indian heritage, archaeological sites that provide an easy way to open the door of consciousness to yesteryear, just echoing across the canyons of time. I get poetic about this. Mexico is, it's a paradox of surprises for the casual visitor. Well, you're not surprised that when you see an elaborate funeral the cost impoverishes the villagers, they're devout Catholics. It's there in hamlets that are steeped by tradition. But you'd be surprised in the urban centers now they have cremation. That jars Catholic tradition. And that provokes that delicious cynical humor from deep in the Mexican soul. Huichol Indians recently began utilizing cremation at modern disposal. And they're very short in stature, about 5'5 or so. And it prompted a letter to the editor of the Daily Excelsior from a traditionalist asserting, quote, if those midgets are turned into ashes, we could put them in pipes and smoke them. Well, insensitive to Anglo-Saxon ears, but acceptable to the Latino psyche. You see, I acquired my entwinement with Mexican public life not just through textbooks or graduate study and that sort of thing, field work, but kind of immersing myself in the culture. I've paid my dues. Anthony Lewis in the New York Times doesn't know where Mexico is, but he got an opinion about it. Karen DeYoung of the Washington Post knows where Mexico is. She doesn't know what it is. Well, I read the Mexican philosophers, Jose Vasconcelos, Justo Sierra, and pondered the exploits of the leaders, you know, Benito Juarez, Lázaro Cárdenas. But you get a feel for Mexico if you burn a little shoe leather like a reporter. You can't always be a political scientist. I've ridden second-class buses out in the countryside, sharing wooden seats with mothers carrying chickens and children and fathers toting piglets and cords of wood. And I've come to the conclusion that Mexico is a cross between a political pamphlet and a travel poster. Its foreign policy can irritate traditional North Americans, you and me, and justifiably, because we're concerned with the Soviet Union and Cuban encroachments into Nicaragua and Marxist supply lines of sophisticated weapons into the communist guerrillas of El Salvador. The Mexican government and its mainstream mass media, though, continue to whitewash the encroachments of the Soviet Union and its satellites into the Caribbean Central American region. And that's on their doorstep as well as ours. Those same Mexican voices, they bellow mindlessly about any real or imagined U.S. presence in Central America, but never the other side. The view is as warped as a wet 2x4. And inasmuch as U.S. private banks and the U.S. government and us taxpayers are the major creditors of Mexico and the Central American republics, what do these critics expect? Pristine isolationism from Washington? We're not supposed to have a presence down there? The Sandinista Marxist regime has uprooted the Miskito and Sumo Indians from their sacred ancestral lands for strategic military sites in the Nicaraguan-Honduran borderlands. Yet not one public outcry in the Mexican media or officialdom against such unconscionable, brutal actions. Folks, if the United States had uprooted the Navajos and the Hopis from their sacred lands in Arizona and New Mexico to build missile sites, even justifiably to counteract Soviet nuclear actions, the UN would have had a field day, an emergency session to condemn us, and American flags would have been burned all over Mexico and the Third World, and you know it. So sometimes in my exasperation over the double standard of developing nations and our own liberal-dominated TV networks, I used to work at NBC when they hired Americans, I give way to Morgan Beatty, Huntley Brinkley those days, but I give way to invective. And then I just can't help it. Maybe they're called third-world nations because they act third-rate. Well, then I recover my modicum of dignity, you know, being a Texas lad like Murchison and U of T grad also. Arizona resident, whatever. I have to have some sort of a razor-thin patina of academic adjustment. We got some scholars in this audience. So I'll hide my deep-felt outrage. And I won't hide it too much. You know, folks, despite the posturing at Harvard and Stanford and so on, Princeton, I taught at the latter two, the congressman's right, you know, and they said last night. But there are still some university professors who realize the worthiness of our own country. So candidly, I'm trying to look at Mexico in this talk as a U.S. citizen. I have a point of view. Certainly Mexican intellectuals perceive of Uncle Sam with the eyes of Mexicans. Nationalistic, suspicious of the big, rich northern neighbor. And recalling the war of 1846, 1848, of course, Mexico lost significant territory to the United States, so I can see why. But 137 years have elapsed, during which we have been a good neighbor over and over. Uncle Sam gave money and weapons to Madero, Carranza, Obregón, so the Mexican Revolution could establish itself over entrenched feudalism. The United States paid $1 billion 1 year in advance in late 1982 for petroleum not to be delivered until the end of 1983. Pretty good neighbor. To ease Mexico in its first struggles in renegotiating its huge foreign debt payments. Americans are the principal creditors. Texas, Arizona, California banks and so on. New York banks patiently accept token payments on the interest, not knowing if any of the principal of the $95 billion in loans will ever be repaid. The United States serves as a major source of employment for 6 million Mexican citizens a year who wouldn't be employed in their own country, and as Bill Murchison suggested, many of them without papers. 5 million American tourists each year constitute the second or third biggest source of dollar earnings in the Mexican private sector. The good neighbors are each other's major trade partners and so on. But can one find such a positive approach in Mexican textbooks, in Mexican newspapers, magazines, on the radio and television? Very rarely. Not in the mass media, but in restricted class media aimed at industrialists, you know, the trade publications. Well, now there's some good news too. I don't want to make this too negative. Some good news glimmering on the horizon. The earthquake that zoomed to 8.2 on the Richter scale, ravaging the overcrowded capital, is prompting President Miguel de la Madrid to push in earnest for some decentralization of both government and industry. Not even the disastrous gas explosion in the Mexican industrial suburbs in November 84 evoked a beginning on the oft-promised decentralization. Ever since the presidency of Adolfo Ruiz Cortines, 1952-58, every chief executive has publicly vowed to decentralize. But last week, De La Madrid did something specific about it. Last week, he flatly ordered some of the demolished buildings will not be rebuilt. There will be parkways, and those buildings will be relocated out in the boondocks. A majority of the 420 buildings destroyed in the earthquake were owned or leased by the government, so he can do that. De La Madrid said sub-cabinet posts are going to move to nearby states, and the cabinet ministries will be linked to him with satellite communications. He spelled all this out last week in a major talk. So far, De La Madrid has not ordered the federal attorney general to prosecute the former officials of the López Mateos presidency, 1958-64, who took bribes so that the contractors of the gigantic complex of buildings of the Ministry of Communications would be built without expensive concrete cradle foundations. Such a foundation is required under the federal law of 1957. That was right after a mild earthquake that law was passed. De La Madrid did send to federal prison Jorge Diaz Serrano, who headed Pemex, the government agency running the petroleum industry during 1976-82. He and his accomplices stole $1 billion from Pemex. I said billion, and that's one man, the chief crook. His wife, whom he hastily divorced after signing over his Swiss bank accounts, lives in luxury on the French Riviera, Saint-Tropez, awaiting him. He's serving a 5-year prison term. $1 billion, that's $200 million a year, that's not bad. Of course, De La Madrid has not prosecuted former President López Portillo, who was involved with Díaz Serrano. You know, folks, that's too dangerous a precedent. You don't start prosecuting former presidents, not if you're a president. Yet De La Madrid is trying to decentralize. He did send several high officials of the López Portillo and Echeverría presidencies to prison, several. He did begin some austerity programs. He even fired, last July the 25th, and I was in Mexico City when it happened, he even fired several thousand federal bureaucrats right on the spot. Some of them were phantom relatives who were just on the payroll, but quite a few of them were actually in the government. And in his September the 1st State of the Union address recently, De La Madrid announced a 30% cut in spending in 50 federal entities. Are you listening, Washington? 50 federal entities, including 15 cabinet ministries, and even a 10% cut in the budget of the presidency itself. Not since the depth of the economic depression in 1934, a half century ago, has any Mexican president reduced the bureaucracy and its budgets in such a meaningful manner. De La Madrid is not our own type of conservative, but he's the least radical Mexican president since the presidency of Miguel Alemán, 1946-52. So I'd like to close with this. We can criticize our neighbor, with constructive motivation. But we ought to doff our Stetson, sombrero maybe, in a salute to the efforts that De La Madrid is making. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a most interesting and actually upbeat view of what is happening in this vital part of the world.